We do shift gears here. You know, I'm not sure about you. I guess all of us are movie fans to one extent or another. I'm kind of rabid about the whole thing. I'm a fan and a collector, and of all the thousands of movies that I've bought and scooped up and stashed at home in various formats dating back a lot of years, my favorite is The Godfather. That's a personal call, of course. I don't expect you to believe it or agree with it, but my personal favorite also happens to be considered the greatest film ever made by many of the critics. It's a movie that almost wasn't made. It almost stumbled at multiple points during the production. The story of how it was produced, how it was put together, how the cast was assembled, how it was written is a drama worthy of its own movie, I think. It is also the subject of a new book called Leave the Gun, Take the Cannoli, the epic story of the making of The Godfather by Mark Seal. Mark is my next guest. He joins us here in just a moment with some great stories about how this movie was put together. We'll be right back. Mark Seal is a veteran author and journalist who joined Vanity Fair, one of the world's great magazines, as a contributing editor back in 2003, covered all kinds of stories about Bernie Madoff and various scandals, Tiger Woods, the making of some classic films, including Pulp Fiction. And back in 2008, he got an assignment. I don't know, maybe he lobbied for that assignment to work on a story about the making of The Godfather, perhaps the greatest movie ever made. The result of that assignment, where he started collecting information 13 years ago, is a new book called Leave the Gun, Take the Cannoli. I've read it now twice. It is incredibly entertaining and fun read. And Mark, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Thank you, George. Great to be here. Good morning.
Appreciate you staying up this late. I know if you're on the East Coast, it's pretty early in the morning for you, but so glad that you decided to join us. The title, of course, I asked you about this once before. The title is from the movie, but you say it's an ad lib. That wasn't in the script.
Exactly. Yeah, it was an ad lib by Clemenza, who was played by Richard Castellano. And after they shoot and kill Pauly Gatto, the turncoat who sold Don Corleone out to be shot, they drive him out to a desolate road in the shadow of the Statue of Liberty, with the statues back to the murder scene. And after they shoot him, Castellano says, leave the gun, which was in the script that was written by Francis Ford Coppola and Mario Puzo. But as a total ad-lib, he says, but take the cannoli. He remembers what his wife told him that morning, don't forget the cannoli. And it's one of the greatest ad-libs ever said, and obviously one of the great lines in the movie.
I mentioned that you started working on this collecting material that became this book in 2008 as an assignment for Vanity Fair. Did you lobby for that assignment, or they just gave
it
to you out of the blue?
Yeah. Yes. I was fascinated with the movie, and, you know, it was like a, you know, what could be more fun and more interesting and more compelling than to trace the making of a great film like The Godfather? So I was, frankly, overjoyed when my editor said yes, and I was able to go down this rabbit hole and interview some of the filmmakers, the actors, the producer, Robert Evans, who was the head of the studio at the time, and it was just a joy from start to finish.
Well, I love how you set it up. The start is you're meeting with Robert Evans, and it's great that you got to meet him back then, because he's gone now, but he was such an amazing character, looked like a movie star. But when he took the reins of what would become this classic, he didn't really have much of a track record. So talk about meeting him, the circumstances of how you watched the movie with him, and then we'll take it from there.
Yes, so I went to his house in Beverly Hills, and his butler met me at the door, a wonderful British man, and he took me into the where the dining room table was, which was covered in photographs and memorabilia from the film. And then Evans made his entrance, which was grand. He was a movie star. He was an actor before he became a producer and before he became the head of Paramount production. And he entered. His hair was slicked back. His face was tanned. He stared out through rose-colored glasses. And after some introductions, he said, let's go to bed. And I went, what? And he explained that his screening room had burned down recently, and he and his friends watched movies in bed. And so we went in, and we laid on his bed and watched parts of The Godfather as he told me the story of how The Godfather came to be.
Oh my gosh. So, and in that same chapter, you talk about being what it was like when he premieres the film. Because they didn't know what the reaction was going to be in light of all the drama that we're going to talk about over the next 2 hours. But describe that scene, what it was like.
Yeah, so the movie was almost not made. It was mob movies didn't play back then. Paramount had made a film called The Brotherhood with Kirk Douglas, and while it wasn't a critical failure, it was a commercial failure. It was a box office failure, and so Paramount wasn't eager to make The Godfather, but Mario Puzo's novel, The Godfather, was racing up the bestseller list, so they were forced, in a way, to do it. And in the beginning, no director wanted to touch it. Nobody wanted to glorify the mafia, and it was seen as a chance, as a gamble, and so that's how they went to Francis Ford Coppola.
When the premiere happened, as you write in the first chapter, there's a lot of big shots there, of course. That's a grand event, as premieres often are. And at the end, after the audience has seen the movie, it's silence. So Robert Evans, you say, felt like this is a disaster.
Yeah, because what happened was is that everyone was stunned in the silence. After the lights came on, after 3 hours, Evans was sitting there. Robert Evans, the head of production at Paramount, was sitting there. One side was his wife, Ally McGraw, and the other side was his guest, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, and a star-studded audience. And the lights come on, and nobody said a word. It was like people were stunned into silence. And Evans thought, this is a bomb. What is this silence about? And then it happened across America and around the world that people were just floored and stunned and beyond words, was the reaction to this amazing film that they had seen.
Tell me a little bit about Evans, and his background and why he would be a long shot guy to take the reins at Paramount and to create such a masterpiece.
Yeah, so Evans was an was a he was the co-owner of Evan Bacon, which was a clothing company, and he was discovered at the Beverly Hills Hotel one day, where he was on clothing company business, and Norma Shearer, the actress, was looking for someone to play her late husband in a movie, The Man of a Thousand Faces, and they thought Evans would be great because he was a very handsome man. And he looked like an actor, and so he became an actor, and then he became a producer. But then Charlie Bluenord, the mercurial owner of the studio, because he was the head of Gulf and Western, which was the parent company, wanted he the studio was really struggling, and Bluenord was trying to do things himself, and so he thought he saw an article in the New York Times about Robert Evans. And he thought, this is the guy to run the studio, even though Evans had not really produced a movie at that point. And Hollywood greeted him with great skepticism in the beginning.
Well, Paramount was in trouble, right?
Yes, exactly. Paramount had produced some films that weren't exactly burning up the box office at that point. Evans came on board, and they started doing better. And then they produced Love Story, which was a reprieve for the studio, but wasn't a rescue. And then The Godfather came along, and that turned out to be the rescue.
Before we go to Mario Puzo and the writing of it, tell me about the guy who's just Charlie, this guy who's the head of Gulf and Western, how he made his money. It's something like an auto parts, wasn't it?
Yeah, Charlie Bluedorn was an immigrant. He came over when he was a young man, still in his teens, and he became a commodities trader and excelled at that. He excelled at pretty much everything he did. He loved deals. He was a takeover artist. He got into the auto parts business, and he kept amassing companies until finally he took over Paramount. And Paramount was on the brink of ruin, and he was a volcanic takeover artist. He spoke, to hear him speak was almost like street poetry. He spoke in a way that was uniquely his own, and he had and he was determined to turn Paramount around, to make Paramount great. And he, in the beginning, tried to do it himself, and people were skeptical in Hollywood, of course, to say the least. But eventually, by hiring Robert Evans and greenlighting The Godfather, he was able to do it.
Yeah, the Hollywood kind of looked down their noses at him. He wouldn't be the first rich guy who knows nothing about movies to come in and squander his fortune.
Exactly. And but he was determined to do something with Paramount, and it was really in the beginning just one of his companies, but in the end it became the premier, company that Gulf and Western had in its stable. But without it was this complete combination of all these unlikely forces and individuals that almost like magic made this movie happen, because none of these disparate parts seem to be, destined for a great masterpiece like this, but they all came together around this movie in the most unlikely way possible.
Yeah, Charlie Bluthorn, a guy who has no movie experience, buys this studio that's almost out of business. He hires a guy, Robert Evans, who has very little experience in producing it, puts him in charge of the whole thing. And then they get the rights to a book written by a guy who is a most unlikely bestseller, Mario Puzo. He's sort of like the hero of your book, Leave the Gun, Take the Cannoli, in that you really end up rooting for the guy. And I get the sense that you really came to like him as you learn more about him.
Yeah, well, you can't help but love Mario Puzo. Everybody who met him fell in love with him. I think he's really the true hero of The Godfather. He was a lovable but financially down-and-out writer. He had an amazingly fertile imagination, but he also had a gambling habit that kept him financially struggling in near poverty for his first 40 years or so. And he struggled as a writer. He had written two novels. The first one earned him, I think, 3,500 or 3,000. No, 3,500. The second had 30. He earned 3,000. So he was going backwards as a writer. And one day or one night, he suffered a gallbladder attack, a severe gallbladder attack, which drove him into the New York Night in a taxi cab from his home in suburban New York. And he directed the taxi to take him to the VA hospital in New York City. And once he arrived at the hospital, the pain of the gallbladder attack really struck, and he fell out of the cab and into a gutter. And he would later tell Time magazine that that night he was laying in the gutter, staring up at the night sky, and he said that was the moment he decided to become rich and famous. He was going to quit writing for art. He was going to write for money. And he went home in his basement, and amid, he had five kids at that point, and over a manual typewriter, he began to dream up the family Corleone.
You say that he, I think you wrote and others have written, that he didn't really know mobsters up close and personal, a single mobster used as a model, but he grew up around him. He grew up around mobsters in Hell's Kitchen, and he's from an Italian family, so must have had some appreciation for how it worked. Talk about that, how rough his upbringing was, and the surroundings that inspired what he would later write.
Yeah, so he grew up in a very large family, an Italian American family in Hell's Kitchen. At that point, he was poor. He wrote at one point that at one point in his school, the school teachers asked the kids to bring a can of food for the poor. And he said, not knowing that he was the poor, that all the poor kids went out and stole a can of food to bring to the school. So he grew up poor, and he said he never met a genuine gangster. But throughout his life, he was surrounded by these men, and he knew their world. He observed them from afar, and sometimes, he observed them a little closer than afar. He wrote at one point, a man threw a blanket full of guns into his mother's living room and ask the mother to keep them for him for a while. And it turned out this man was possibly a mafia man, he later wrote. So he knew these men, but, you know, he knew their world. But he created the Corleones from his research. At that point, the Kefauver hearings were happening, which were the Senate hearings about organized crime that introduced the mafia to America. And people were riveted around the country. These hearings were held in, I think, 19 cities across America, and most of them were televised. And it was like incredible ratings, and people were glued to their television sets, and Robert Kennedy was involved. And Puzo ordered these hearings from the Library of Congress for $10, I think he wrote, and began watching, you know, listening and reading and learning. And with all the, he was an amazing researcher, and he was able to take this research and create from fact a fictional story that was greater than any factual story could ever have been.
And he was able to draw on his own life experiences and then what he learned from those hearings as models for what was to come. You mentioned about this incident where a mafia guy tosses a container of guns into his mom's place and she hides them for him. That becomes a scene for young Vito Corleone, right?
Yeah, so, excuse me. Yeah, so so many things about, you know, the hearings were, you know, some of the main figures in organized crime across the country testified at these hearings. And then later there was another hearing with an individual named Joe Valachi, who was the first real turncoat to come forward and speak about the mob on television, certainly. And so Puzo was able to learn from that. He also was a pulp fiction writer. For a while, he wrote for a collection of magazines called Magazine Management, and they produced these pulp fiction magazines about, you know, war and organized crime. He wrote about, and so he just was able to create these worlds from thin air, and that's what he did with the Godfather. He created not only a family of gangsters, but a group of gangsters who were family men and women. And that became the secret. That gave the book heart. That made you care about these people. Otherwise, you know, you would have a group of killers and criminals. But these men had families. And so you care about Vito Corleone as a father and his three sons and the world that he inhabited and the sense of honor that he brought to his job, even though the job was criminal enterprise, because Mario Puzo wrote it as a family story. The producer, Al Ruddy, said there's one reason that movie was successful and one reason only, it may be the greatest family movie ever filmed. that was the secret to both the novel and the screenplay that Puzo wrote with Francis Coppola that became The Godfather.
Yeah, can you root for a guy who's probably been responsible for the murder of hundreds of people? And the answer was yes. I mean, the moviegoers were sad when Corleone died. We're talking with Mark Seal about his book, Leave the Gun, Take the Cannoli. We're talking about what is many regard as the best movie ever made, The Godfather. And The Godfather 2 is right there with it. Mark Seal is the author of a wonderful book, Leave the Gun, Take the Cannoli. It's about the making of The Godfather. If you like those movies, you're going to enjoy this book because it has so many behind-the-scenes tales of what it was like. You know, what did the mafia think about the portrayal in Mario Puzo's novel and then in the movie itself? The reactions were mixed. There were death threats. There was a labor strife, union troubles during the production. A producer's car was shot up, but at the same time, mobsters loved the portrayal. At least some of them did. The idea that they had a code of honor, that they were family men. And some of those wise guys thought Mario Puzo must have mob informants feeding him information, not knowing that he made most of it up. When the movie was being cast, I think there was real-life mob guys wanted roles in the film. Some of them may have made the cut, I'm told. We'll hear about that in a moment. Mark Seal will be sharing stories of the real-life inspirations for some of the main characters. the struggle to get the right actors in the right roles, because every decision was this knockdown, drag-out battle, kind of worthy of Sonny Corleone beating the hell out of his brother-in-law, Carlo. When we come right back, we're going to get into more of the details dug up by Mark Seal here on Coast to Coast AM. Mark Seal, it occurs to me as I was reading your book, Leave the Gun, Take the Cannoli, that Mario Puzo could have been a character in his own novel, and he probably wouldn't have ended well, given that he was a degenerate, or at least a very avid gambler who was always in debt to Shylocks, loan sharks, different kinds of scurrilous characters, always on the edge of going under. You could see him as a character in the movie running into the Corleones and sleeping with the fishes.
You could, yes. But he, you know, once he got his advance, which was relatively low, I think it was like the last part was $1,200 or something. He took his family on a whirlwind trip through Europe, and he financed it with credit cards, and he would stop at casinos along the way. And so when he got back from his trip, he had promised his wife that he would take her back to visit her family in Germany. And so he took all his kids and headed to Europe and was gambling at the casinos, gambling is not only his advance, but all the money that he was getting from credit card advancements. And when he got back, he had told his agent and his editor not to send the book out because it needed to be polished. He had finished The Godfather, but he wanted to work on it more. But unbeknownst to him, they had sent it out to a paperback house, and the paperback house offered close to $400,000 for it. It was obviously an amazing read, you know. And so when he got back, his agent said, you know, you just had an offer of $400,000, you know, where he had earned $3,500 for his last book or $3,000 for his last book. He said, you got to be kidding me, you know. And it turned out to be not only true, they ended up offering a record at the time of $410,000. And he said he took the check, the first hundred or whatever he got, to the bank teller that used to laugh at all of his overdrafts and kind of treat him with disdain. And he said he loved the look on his face when he handed him that $100,000 or however much it was check. And he said that he also wrote later that he went back to the publisher or his editor not long after that and said he needed another $100,000. The editor said, wait, we just gave you $100,000 not too long ago. He said, well, $100,000 doesn't last forever. He was a lovable guy, and yes, you're right. You know, the portrayal of Don Corleone and his sons and his wife and his daughter and the wedding and Johnny Fontaine and all those indelible characters seemed so real to members of organized crime that there was a rumor that went out that he was paid to write the book by organized crime, which was obviously not true, and all of these other things that he had to have inside information. But Mario Puzo had an amazing imagination and was an incredible researcher and one of the great writers of our time, and he just was able to dream up this world.
Were there publishers that passed on it altogether?
Yeah, I think 8 publishers passed on it, he would later write, people were skeptical of a book about organized crime. I mean, what was the audience for it? But as I said before, it was the family aspect of it, you know, that these people were, he created them through a lens that really hadn't been done to this extent before, where it wasn't just a novel, it was almost a fable, it was a myth. It was a myth about not only the mafia, but it was also a myth about immigration and the American dream and fathers and sons and the love of a family of immigrants who came to this country seeking everything that America stands for, only to be, you know, end up as criminals. So, you know, it had this heart to it that I think made it irresistible to readers. And not only in America, but worldwide, it became one of the great bestsellers of its time.
Do you know offhand how many copies have sold, paperback, hardback?
There were millions. I'm not sure of the exact number, but it was, you know, it was number one on the bestseller list of the New York Times bestseller list for months, if not years, and then it went around the world, and everybody, you know, Paramount had to make the movie at that point because, you know, you couldn't deny this book. People, it was the hottest book of its day, and Paramount had this property really cheap. You know, I think it was $12,500 they optioned it for. There's varying, as I write in the book, there's varying stories of how Paramount acquired it. Robert Evans would write and also tell me that Mario Puzo came to him when he was writing the book with the pages under his arm, and Evans said he knew the look of somebody that looked broke. He says, in trouble, and Puzo said yes, and he needed the money to get out of some gambling debts, according to Robert Evans. But Puzo had later said that he didn't meet Evans until he got to Hollywood, and you know the pages went to someone else. And of course, Peter Bart, who was Evans's right-hand man, said the pages came to him. We don't know exactly where how that happened, but Paramount did get the book cheap.
You would have thought there'd be a bidding war for it. Wouldn't there be a bidding war? Well, I guess today there would be.
Today there probably would be a bidding war for a book like that. Can you imagine? I mean, you know, The Godfather coming into today's world with Netflix and HBO and all the other companies that are you know, seeking material like this. I mean, that there would be a huge bidding war for a book like this.
And the publisher didn't like the title?
Yes, that's right. The public—that's according to Mario Puzo's son told me that the publisher didn't like, hated the title, but it wasn't his first title. The first title he called it when he went in to see Robert Evans or whoever he went in to see or however he sent it in was the title of the book was Mafia.
Oh, yeah, this is a lot better. So, Puzo writes a book. It goes crazy. Paramount gets the rights, and then he sticks to his guns. He wants to write the screenplay.
Well, yeah, he didn't want to write it at first, and then Paramount made him an offer he couldn't refuse. And so he flew out to Los Angeles, and he stayed at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and Al Ruddy, the producer, promised his wife, Puzo's wife, that he would keep him on his diet. He was he struggled with diabetes and also throughout his life he had a weight problem. He loved Italian food. He would eat Chinese food with a side of spaghetti. He loved pizza more than anything else. He loved Italian food, and one thing he did not like was fish, which was a common you know, specialty of Los Angeles. And so Al Ruddy told the story about how, you know, Puzo would, in his suite at the Beverly Hills Hotel, would, you know, Ruddy tried to keep him on a diet. He would take him to breakfast, and they would have like an egg and a boiled pear, and then lunch the same thing. And then, but Puzo kept gaining weight while Ruddy kept losing weight. And one night, Ruddy was at a pizza parlor, and the owner said, Mario Puzo's a great guy. And Ruddy said, how do you know that? He said, I take a pizza to him every night at the Beverly Hills Hotel.
So he's working on the screenplay, and in the course of making the film, you know, a lot of mafia people are weighing in on it, and some of them want parts. Talk about that.
Yeah, so, you know, at the time, in the beginning, there were people that didn't want the movie made. Al Ruddy received threats. There were letters coming into his office from around the country, from powerful people from around the country and government, that they didn't want the movie made. One night, Ruddy and his staff would exchange cars because they felt they were being followed. And one night, Ruddy's assistant, Betty McCart, who I was able to interview for the Vanity Fair story, said she drove her car, or Al Ruddy's sports car, up to her home on Mulholland Drive. And in the middle of the night, she heard gunshots. And when she came out the next morning, the windshield had been blasted out. And there was a note on the windshield saying that certain people did not want this movie made.
And then some of them wanted in. They wanted in a big way. Yeah.
what happened was it was a group called the Italian American Civil Rights League, and they were dedicated to ending what its members perceived as the stereotyping of Italian Americans in popular culture, especially film. And the league was founded by a man named Joe Colombo, who was reputed to be one of the head of the five families, the five mob families of New York. And it later was determined that he, you know, didn't want the movie made because he felt like movies like The Godfather, he felt, would add to the stereotyping of Italian Americans in film. And so suddenly, when the production moved to New York began the work of setting up locations, and the locations suddenly were revoked, permits were withdrawn, truck drivers threatened to stop working, stalling the film in its tracks. And then the film producer, Al Ruddy, met with Colombo and the league, and it turned out that they wanted one thing, and that's that the word mafia not be used in the script. And Ruddy knew that there was only one point in the script that the word mafia was used, and he agreed to take it out. And it was a big backlash in the press that, you know, they had made this deal, it seemed. But by taking that one word out, the streets of New York opened and a world of cooperation ensued, with some, as you say, men who were connected wanting roles in the part, in the movie.
So there's a real-life mob boss who starts an organization complaining about the stereotyping of Italian-Americans as mob figures, and he really was a mob figure. He was the head of one of the five families.
Well, that's what was said at the time, and anyway, he was quite a powerful individual, at that point, the movie was off and running and filming in New York City. You know, in the beginning, there was talk that the studio wanted to film it in Kansas City or St. Louis because New York was the most expensive place to film a movie. But Francis Ford Coppola, who envisioned so much that became, you know, the magic of this film, insisted on it being filmed in New York. There was also pressure to film it in present day, which Coppola insisted to do it in the 40s at the time of the novel, which, you know, Puzo's novel was set in the 40s. And I think that is what made The Godfather so great. And that's why I think you can watch The Godfather today and it doesn't feel dated, because it was dated when it was made. It was made, you know, in the 40s. So it feels as fresh today as it did 50 years ago when it was first premiered.
Well, for sure. I mean, I don't know how many times I've seen it, probably 50. And every time I walk past a TV, if there's a Godfather or Godfather 2 is on, I'm stuck there for a while. I can't get over it. A lot of the characters who the world knows now were inspired by real-life people, the information came from real-life people. You write that Mario Puzo did research during his gambling junkets to Las Vegas. He would quiz pit bosses, roulette dealers. One of the people who became a source for him is Carl Cohen, who was a manager at the Sands, a guy who is notorious for punching out the front teeth of Frank Sinatra when he was on a bender. And you say that he got into a beef with an actor who was making a scene out of control drunk, and he coined an immortal line, right?
Yes, exactly. Well, you know, as so many things about The Godfather, there's various viewpoints. Some people say that the line came out of Puzo. Mario Puzo said some of the great lines issued by Don Corleone were spoken first by his mother. And this line could have been spoken by Mario's mother, but the people that I interviewed told me that one night Carl Cohen was subduing. It was an actor, David Jansen, who was in The Fugitive, he was, I don't know if he was causing a scene or what, but there was some problem that he was having in the casino or somewhere. Anyway, so Carl Cohen, according to this source, said he subdued him and calmed him down, and everything was fine. And then the pit boss said, "Carl, how did you do that?" And he said, "I made him an offer he couldn't refuse." And of course, that line went around the pit, and Mario Puzo was gambling that evening. And according to some, that's where the line came from. Other people say, of course, it came from Puzo's mother.
A lot of the lines came from Puzo's mother. A lot of the lines uttered by Don Corleone come from or inspired by Puzo's mom, right?
Exactly. His mother seemed like a wonderful, Italian-American mother who, loved her kids but was very strong and kept Mario on the straight and narrow. And he was the first writer to come out of his family. You know, his family was an Italian American family, hard workers, immigrants, it was a miracle that he became a writer, that he was determined to become a writer. And this writing in the beginning was such drudgery for him, because even though I'm sure he loved it, and you can see it in his writing, I was able to look at all of his, not all, but a lot of his early work, which was all really great, but it wasn't commercially great. So it kept him struggling to feed, five kids and keep a roof over their heads. And until The Godfather, he really had a tough road to follow on that.
We're talking with Mark Seal, whose book, Lead the Gun, Take the Cannoli, is the epic story of the making of The Godfather. One of the central characters is a singer named Johnny Fontaine, who bears some remarkable similarities to Frank Sinatra, who was not a fan of the book. We're going to hear that part of the story and the story of the choosing of the cast in our next segment on Coast to Coast.